Lost Highways from History Colorado is made possible by the Sturm Family Foundation, proud supporters of the humanities and the power of storytelling for more than 20 years.
Okay, Tyler, are you ready to spin the dial on our talk radio time machine?
Yep, you got it set to 1984.
Yep, here we go.
I was wrong today. You're kind of nappy-headed hoes there, I'm going to tell you that.
The Spanish people have the worst taste of music. It's all like, you know, dead.
The Limbaugh Institute for Advanced Conservative...
See, all the...
He's a prince. He's primitive. He's provocative. He's Alan Berg, and he's next on News Talk 85 KOA. Try your luck at talking with him now. Dial 861-8255. That's 861-TALK. And now, here's Alan Berg.
And thank you. And we're back for our final half hour of the show, so join us. We have lines open. This has been just an incredibly terrible day. All right, 861-TALK, 861-8255, Alan Berg on KOA, line 3, you're on the air.
Hey, Alan, it's Nolan Tyler.
We're calling from the future.
Why are you listening?
Well, we've been working on this story about talk radio, and American politics have become so polarized here in the future. Obviously, you're trying to entertain people, but don't you think that the way that talk radio profits from outrage and controversy could have dangerous consequences? Do you ever worry that something bad could happen?
I don't think that's true. I think it's sad that you can't address the issues that we're talking about rather than just finding this a personal attack. It is an attack.
Wait, but can we just ask you something real quick?
Well, I know what you would say anyway. Go ahead.
Well, it's just that you can come off as really offensive sometimes, and...
You've been whining on talk radio. Why do you listen if it offends you? Take a walk. Line 1, you're on KOA.
Hello, Alan.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never called...
From History Colorado Studios, this is Lost Highways, dispatches from the shadows of the Rocky Mountains. I'm Noel Black.
And I'm Tyler Hill.
On each episode, Tyler and I look back at overlooked stories from our home state of Colorado in the West.
Stories that we can't believe we never heard.
Stories that help paint a more complex picture of this place we call home.
And how we got to now.
As a heads up, there's a lot of language from talk radio in this episode that some people might find offensive.
In January 1984, Denver talk radio personality Alan Berg appeared in a segment on the CBS news program 60 Minutes.
He was featured along with a cast of rising stars in the growing market of confrontational call-in radio hosts.
Here he is talking to reporter Morley Safer about what he sees as the virtues of talk radio.
It's the last neighborhood in town. People don't talk to each other anymore. Talk radio is the last place for them to hear human voices. So many people are isolated today, they don't have a chance to communicate.
But what are the people who listen to radio call-in shows actually hearing? Those who listen to Berg get a mixed bag of mayhem and malarkey. Political science and pop psychology, common law and uncommon sense, all of it laced with aggression, abuse, and sarcasm.
On June 18th, 1984, only 6 months after this 60 Minutes segment aired, Berg was gunned down in his driveway as he stepped out of his black VW Bug. He was holding a bag of dog food for his Airedale Fred.
1984 would prove to be a momentous year for talk radio. Not only was Alan Berg murdered, but a relatively unknown DJ and sports commentator took to the AM airwaves in Sacramento, doing politics this time.
The doctor of democracy makes another house call.
This is a special edition of the Rush Limbaugh program, America Held Hostage. And
now from our... It's fair to say that Rush Limbaugh was... or is the biggest influence in the creation of modern talk radio.
This is Jeffrey Berry, professor of political science at Tufts University in Boston. He and his colleague, Sarah Soberai, are the authors of a book called The Outrage Industry, Political Opinion Media and the New Incivility. They study the history and political impact of talk radio.
It's unclear if Limbaugh was aware of Alan Berg at the time he launched his show.
But he was one of many talk radio hosts adopting a more abrasive style that Berg and others had started to popularize.
Limbaugh may be one of the most well-known names in his field, But Barry says that inflammatory talk radio can be traced all the way back to the 1920s, when Christian evangelists like Amy Semple McPherson started using it to spread their message.
Then, in the 1930s, things took a turn toward the political.
Well, using the radio for political purposes precedes what we think of as talk radio. So you can go back to Father Coughlin.
We are Christian insofar as we believe in Christ's principle of love your neighbor as yourself. And with that principle, I challenge every Jew in this nation to tell me that he does not believe in it.
It's important because what he did was try to inflame public opinion through the harsh rhetoric of the radio. So in a sense, he's a forerunner.
In the 1930s, DJs like John J. Anthony and Barry Gray were pioneering the early versions of what would become the call-in format.
Then, in the 1960s, a disc jockey and TV host named Joe Pine developed a more confrontational style of talk show.
You want to walk away?
I think
fine,
this is a circus and that you're a fool and that you're not in any way discussing
you're a liar and a danger
any
to the
issue.
Country.
His call-in show was one of the most successful of those early programs and would eventually be syndicated on over 250 stations across the country.
By the time the late 70s and early 80s rolled around, music stations were migrating en masse to the FM side of the dial.
That's because FM gave stations the ability to broadcast in stereo instead of mono.
This left AM stations in the lurch.
What are we going to do now that music has moved to the FM side, which has stereo and all of that? We've got to find something to do.
This is Lee Larson. In the early 1980s, he was the general manager of Denver's KOA, one of the biggest AM stations in the Western U.S.
And that's what birthed a lot of the talk formats of different types, the sports talks and the psychology talks and the local affairs talks. And then just the natural growth out of that was that, you know, the country was maturing, the issues of the day always becoming more and more important on a national basis.
Andrew Horvitz, a sociologist from the State University of New York in New Paltz, has done a lot of research on talk radio. He told us that it's always been pretty easy to make talk and call-in shows profitable.
Because unlike FM, unlike music, you would get something on AM that you would call an active listener or an engaged listener, right? You paid attention to the shows. You stuck with the people through the discussions. You want to stick through those commercials to hear what wonderful slash outrageous, depending on what side of things you're on, really what's going to be said. You stick through the commercials, and that makes you a very valuable radio demographic to go after.
AM stations across the country were discovering that outrage sells.
Steve Kane in Miami, Gary D in Washington, D.C., Howard Stern in New York, and others were all pioneering a combative style of AM radio that was driving numbers through the roof.
In fact, during a one-year stint at WWDC in Washington, Howard Stern more than tripled the station's ratings. And around that same time, Denver saw the rise of its own king of call-in, a dapper, trash-talking, chain-smoking, coffee-guzzling, hot-headed Jewish man from Chicago named Alan Berg.
4-6 is our number, talking about masturbation, lesbianism, homosexuality, God, it all one big ugly mess. Good morning.
Yes, Alan, how are you?
For those who knew him best, Berg was something of a spectacular mess himself. Here's his ex-wife, Judith Berg, fellow talk show hosts Ken Hamblin and Peter Boyles, and longtime KOA producer Aneth White.
Well, he was very thin, very tall.
Alan was tall and lanky. He had bangs and gray hair. He had a beard and a mustache, and he had a dog.
Adored his Airedale, Fred.
Everybody loved Fred.
Yeah, Fred. And Berg and Fred were twins.
I best describe him as a Muppet, and he was an impeccable dresser. I never saw him, whether it was my home or we're out for dinner or working together. He came in with a tie on. Always.
All the kitchen cabinets were full of boxes of his excellent shoes. There was almost no food in there except dog food, but shoes.
I can close my eyes. I see him with a cigarette in one hand and a cup of black coffee in the other hand.
He was a terrible, terrible smoker, and I would say, could you please have Mr. Berg not leave ashes all over the studio? Well, he was a chain smoker.
He would light the cigarette off the cigarette.
Along with a cup of coffee, because he drank something like 40 cups of coffee a day. and a cigarette in the other hand, and you know, and that scratchy, loudish, impossible to miss voice.
My dear, anybody who's programmed like you is per se a racist.
Listen, I'm
per se.
I'm a wonderful Christian mother.
Honey, you
they
are.
Taught me the honey, right way.
You are committable. Goodbye. 761-364.
Alan Berg was raised on the south side of Chicago. He was born in 1934. So he was one of those guys in between the wars, came of age in the 50s.
This is Steven Singular, author of Talk to Death, a biography about Alan Berg.
He had very significant issues, I think, around race. And part of it, I think, was that he had conflict with his father. His father was a dentist. I think he told me he was an unforgivable dentist. Classic Bergian phrase. And I think he felt that his father was something of a racist. And I think it's what made him ultra-sensitive about issues of race, bigotry, etc., as he got older.
Racism would always bother Alan. And his on-air provocations and pot-stirring often centered around advocating for the underdog or calling out hypocrisy where race, class, and sexuality were concerned.
And Berg had the brains to back up his bluster.
In 1951, when he was just 17 years old, he studied psychology at the University of Colorado in Boulder. 5 years later, he got a law degree from DePaul in Chicago and became one of the youngest people to ever pass the Illinois bar exam.
After he passed the bar, Berg took work in Chicago as a criminal defense lawyer.
Things were going well. In 1958, he married Judith Halpern, his college sweetheart from Denver. And at that time, he was making really good money.
But his success had a dark side. Here's Judith.
His clients were mafiosos, if I may use that word. And it became very easy for people to get to Alan Berg, and he could fix everything. And Chicago was so crooked.
He could go in the courtroom and he could defend somebody who had done something awful, and he could succeed and get them off or their sentence reduced, but he didn't like himself doing it. He didn't like the hypocrisy within himself.
Around that time, says Singular, Alan discovered martinis.
He was not a good drunk. He was a kind of a nasty drunk. He didn't like what he was doing. He didn't like the fact that he was succeeding at it, and he started to drink more and more, and he started to pass out and just sort of go downhill. He's very bright. He was talented, but he was somewhat out of control.
Not long after he started drinking more, Alan was diagnosed with epilepsy.
His then-wife Judith convinced him to quit his law practice and move back to Denver in the hopes that his health would improve.
He went to rehab, got sober, and always the clothes horse, opened up a clothing store.
And the customers would come in and he would, you know, talk their ear off. One day, a man came in named Lawrence Gross. Lawrence had a show on a local radio station, and he thought Berg was just the fastest on his feet with a gift of gab and could talk about anything. And he said, you know, you ought to come on the radio with me someday. You know, you might be good at this.
And it turned out he was.
He went on the Lawrence Gross show, and they were talking about, you know, how to walk your dog or cut your flowers or something. And he starts in on the two major things that always work on talk radio, which is religion and sex, or race being the third. And he just blew Gross out of the water, and people started calling in. And Denver didn't have anything remotely like this. I mean, they had never seen or heard anything like Alan Berg. He had incredible energy, incredible verbal gifts, and he was funny.
The years Alan spent arguing criminal defense cases had inadvertently prepared him for a career in talk radio.
He started making regular guest appearances on Lawrence Gross's show.
And before long, he got his own slot.
He was safe behind that microphone. He would sit in there, he smoked packs of cigarettes a day, and he would start fires in the trash cans, he would start fires on his desk, he was just absolutely chaotic. He would bat the microphone away, but this was his calling.
I know, and I know for a fact there are 8 and 10 generations that are on welfare.
You don't think it has anything to do with repression and discrimination that's occurred, do you?
Well, it doesn't seem to be that.
Oh, of course not, dear. You're as dumb as the rest. I can't take this sellout. Blacks couldn't get jobs. Chicanos couldn't get jobs. Civil Rights Commission comes along. We have a fair guy there. Reagan bounces him out to get a token black guy on there who probably never saw a black person in a ghetto in his whole life or understands the problem. I'll be back with you tomorrow with more grief and hate and maybe a laugh or two. Stay tuned for the evening report.
But in 1976, just as Alan was starting to make a name for himself, his epilepsy caught up with him. He had an especially bad seizure that wouldn't stop.
They took him to the ER room, and he was diagnosed with a brain tumor, a very significant brain tumor. And they said, we have only one option here, and it is essentially to cut off the top of your head to go in, take out the tumor, and, you know, you'll never probably work again. You're lucky if you'll be able to talk. And they went in, and about a month later, he's back on the radio talking like a magpie.
Because you ain't doing the right thing here. You haven't got what the people want, and you don't know what you're doing with it, and you're a loser. And that's it. Line two, you're on KOA.
What side of the bed did you get up on this?
Hey, I'm in a great mood. What are you talking
about? Well, you blew my argument. I called in.
He went through I think what he would have acknowledged was kind of a bad period in which he started becoming more and more aggressive, and some would say more and more obnoxious on the radio, and he started hanging up on everybody and making snide comments and doing all the things that he knew how to do. And they held a poll in Denver, and they said, we want you to vote for the most popular and the least popular media personality in Denver, and he won both awards.
As he built his career and developed his persona as a talk show host, Alan had a string of gigs at various small stations around Denver.
First at KGMC, replacing Lawrence Gross, who took a job in San Diego.
Then KGMC changed to KWBZ.
And Alan moved to KHOW shortly after.
He was fired from KHOW and then went back to KWBZ.
Until that station changed to an all-music format.
He considered a job in Oklahoma City, but Peter Boyles told us that when he went there for an audition, things didn't exactly go according to plan.
He gets to Oklahoma and he throws the mic switch and somebody calls the radio show and said, I need everybody to know that in Denver, Colorado, this man called Jesus Christ a black homosexual. That game's over.
Berg came back to Denver, and that's when he ended up at KOA, which at 50,000 watts was one of the most powerful radio stations in the country.
KOA was, and still is, what's called a clear channel station.
Not to be confused with the Clear Channel Broadcasting Company.
It's part of a group of 60 frequencies across the country that in 1941 were given high power signals and special permission to have their frequency cleared from all other broadcast channels.
They were the original emergency broadcast system, and the idea was that from anywhere in the country, listeners could have access to at least two clear channel stations in the event of an emergency.
When Alan Berg was on KOA in the 1980s, his show reached a massive part of the western U.S., especially at night when AM radio waves are reflected off the ionosphere.
At the time, you could hear KOA in parts of 30 states and as far away as Los Angeles, even in Canada.
And you still can.
But the commercial success of Berg's provocations would come with a price.
Support for History Colorado comes from the Coors Brewing Company. Coors is proud to sponsor Beer Here, Brewing the New West, now on view at the History Colorado Center in Denver. The exhibition features artifacts and insights that reveal why Coloradans today enjoy 360 breweries and counting. More than just a tale of ale, Beer Here is a story of Colorado, told over a few beers.
By the time Alan Berg got to KOA in 1981, his show had settled into a rhythm.
He would dance back and forth between frivolous, hot-button topical items and impassioned engagement around issues like race, religion, and sexuality.
Sometimes all within the same show.
Alan's approach was different because he was talking about the issues of the day, but he would mix that with some of the funniest, craziest, goofiest observations that he had on society.
Former KOA general manager Lee Larson says Allen was always happy to play devil's advocate.
He was one of the first talk show hosts I was aware of that would also sort of take whatever side of an argument he needed to be able to engage with a caller. And he went on the air with this approach of that this was just outrageous and just unacceptable. But it was kind of what I would call a shtick.
I'm pretty upset about what the government is doing as far as bringing in all the refugees. You know, like people...
Why, because they're showing a work ethic that's better than most Americans? God bless them.
Well, no.
Maybe they'll make a shake up and do something and work and earn something and not want a free ride, sweetheart. Line one. You're on KOA. That didn't play. I wasn't
Alan?
In the mood. Okay.
But, says producer Aneth White, who worked with Berg, he could also play a shtick to make a larger point.
One of the topics that he liked to do every year, it was an annual thing, he did his suntan show. And he would start out talking about why did white people always go out and get out in the sun and try to turn their skin dark. And then he would hit you with, I think it's because white people secretly want to be black. And there would be people that would call in and just be outraged. I don't want to be black, Alan, blah, blah, blah.
I think the most continuing saga, if we could call it that, has been a show. I came up with the idea some 8 years ago. It was an idea about suntanning and the reason people didn't like themselves white, or they really didn't like themselves white, maybe secretly wanting to be black. That show has been a continued craziness for the last 8 years. But it's a funny thing because people have a hard time laughing at themselves, which is something I am always problem with in talk radio. It's too serious. People take everything too seriously. They don't laugh at themselves. And that, to me, is more of a solution to more problems than anything I know. It's better communication if we can share some humor than any other dialogue we have.
To the people who knew Allen well and worked with him closely, there was a fine line between trying to get ratings and the issues that he really cared about.
One of the things that drove Allen was the sense of injustice that the country has about racial issues and all of that all the human rights kinds of topics. So when he did this suntan show, he underneath all of that was the topic of racism and race and trying to talk about that too.
To friend and colleague Peter Boyles, who still works as a conservative talk radio host at Denver station KNUS, Berg was like a professional wrestler.
One of the highlights of my life was I got to work in professional wrestling. I got to do the ring and I got to do television. And I always say that I learned how to do radio from the legendary Bobby the Brain Heenan and Allen Berg.
Here's a clip of professional wrestling announcer Bobby the Brain.
Jealous of me. My whole life, everybody's been jealous of me. Everybody's been worried about me my whole life. They've done this to me. They've done this to me. Don't you call me weasel either, pal.
No, I didn't.
You
said
you're
paranoid.
No, you called me weasel and I heard you.
I said you're trying to weasel out this match.
No, I didn't try to weasel out.
Peter Boyle says that Berg had many of the same theatrical instincts.
He knew how to do it. He's like a pro wrestler. He knew how to build the heat, how to press the buttons, and that was important.
And the pro wrestling metaphor was especially apt when it came to Allen Berg's particular style of radio. Peter explained to us the difference between what those in the wrestling business call a shoot and a work.
A shoot being something real and a work being something not so real. Peter Boyle says that Allen had issues that he genuinely cared about, racism and anti-Semitism being some of the big ones.
Well, he had hot buttons, but when he would do like white people really want to be black, he was putting you on. But he put you on because in some ways, a great story. He came in one afternoon. He would always do afternoon when he get up, and I'm doing mornings. And he comes in and says, I want to talk to you. And I said, what? He said, I'm going on air today and say I'm gay. And I said, I'm looking at him like, what's up your sleeve? So he goes on the show and he goes, I want everybody to know I'm gay. And people calling him, I always knew you were gay. You know? And then he goes, folks, it's just a word. I'm not gay, but it's a word where, you know, and he does this whole, and he's working, you know, he's not, and it's not a shoot, it's a work.
So in other words, the work was to come out as gay, while the shoot was to draw attention to homophobia.
These kinds of over-the-top comical provocations became Berg's trademark on air.
But just like in wrestling, once the show was over, Berg was able to take off the mask. Here's former KOA talk show host Ken Hamblin again.
I found Allen to be, off the air, he was a sweetheart. He was the most gentle, considerate, caring guy you ever wanted to meet. I mean, if you knew Alan off the air, you'd love him, as we all did.
Aneth White agrees. She told us about how she felt when she first learned she'd be working with Alan.
I was nervous, thinking, my goodness, is he going to be like gruff and mean and, you know, lose his temper with me and, you know, be outrageous like his reputation was. And instead, he was gentlemanly and wondering, what did I need? And right away, that was kind of the tone he set. What he was like on the air versus what he was like off mic were very different things. And he was quite easy to work with pretty much all of the time.
And she thinks that even in his most provocative moments, there was some level of intention behind the shtick.
Even when he was being outrageous, where you would think, oh my gosh, I can't believe he just said that, he was usually doing it with a twinkle in his eye.
In this excerpt taken from the 60 Minutes segment we played earlier, you can see Alan smiling as he berates Judith. She told us that she used to call in on slow days to help him out.
Remember when I left you? You never shut up. I got fed up with you. You never let me get a word edgewise. This is my ex-wife. Get out of here.
He enjoyed kind of stirring the pot. And occasionally he would even shock me. But I would think, oh my goodness, I can't believe he just, you know, said that or went there. But most of the time, you know, I know he's been labeled as a shock jock, and that was so not true about him. When he really mixed it up with somebody, it was most of all about things that he really did care about. He took on people who were bigoted, anti-Semitic, racist, but he wanted to engage with the people who held those views and challenge them.
But some people couldn't make those kinds of distinctions, and it was easy for them to mistake Alan's persona for reality. Peter Boyle says that there's a name for those kinds of people in the wrestling business.
And those people are called marks. And they don't call them fans, they call them marks. And they believe it's real. And that was the part about Alan, was Alan was wrestling. They were marking. And there are people that believe all kinds of stuff. Belief is far more powerful than knowledge.
One of those marks was a frequent caller to Alan's show.
I think the Jews are still firmly in control of the Soviet Union. I think they're responsible for the murder of 50 million white Christians.
You think so, huh?
Yes, I do.
I think you're sick. I think you're pathetic. I think your ability to reason and use any logic is a tragedy.
Why don't you put a Nazi on your program and then you have somebody can...
Sir, you are a Nazi by your very own admission.
That's
thanks
right.
So much. If he said that's right, you heard it. Okay, 861-TALK, 861-825.
According to Aneth White, that caller was a neo-Nazi named David Lane.
David Lane had been listening to Alan Berg for years and years and was known to lay on his bed listening and scream at the radio, but continue to listen, sometimes calling in and, you know, arguing with Alan.
And on June 18th, 1984, Lane and three other members of a white nationalist group called The Order assassinated Alan Berg.
Support for History Colorado comes from Colorado State University. CSU embraces the critical role that History Colorado plays in preserving and telling the stories of our state and the West. As Colorado's land-grant university, CSU is proud to be a partner in programming and outreach statewide. As they celebrate 150 years of education, research, and service, CSU remains committed to preserving the past and creating a brighter future. Learn more at colostate.edu.
Here's Ken Hamblin, Peter Boyles, Judith Berg Halpern, Aneth White, biographer Steven Singular, and former Denver Post journalist Kevin Flynn describing the night Alan Berg was murdered.
We had gone to lunch. I had had lunch with him at noon.
And we were going to have dinner that night. And he called me and he said, Judy's in town, his ex-wife. He said, I got to take care of Judy, got to have dinner with Judy. I said, I love you, man. I said, I'll see you tomorrow. He said, I love you.
On the way home, he bought dog food.
They ate dinner in Lakewood, stopped, bought a bag of dog food and a pack of cigarettes.
When they pulled into the driveway in the little Volkswagen Bug, the plan was that they would stop, get out, they would go upstairs to Alan's unit in that condo, the little condo building, and they'd call his mom, Ruth, back in Chicago because her birthday.
And then we were going to go call his mother, but he thought that was too late.
So he puts the car in reverse, backs out, drops Judith off.
We hugged and kissed, and he said, I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Then he came back.
The fickle fingers of fate.
I was home that night, and I got a phone call from Phyllis, one of the other producers.
I was at home, and phone rang, and it was Barry Fay, the old rock promoter.
Seems like it was about 9:30, and she sounded very dramatic.
And Barry said, they killed Alan. You know, and I'm thinking the ratings came in, or, you know, which he had great ratings, so meaning that you could kill the numbers, you know, because you know our business.
And Rick Barber walked into the studio. He didn't say anything. He came and he sat down to a microphone.
I turned on Channel 4, and they were in the street. They were on Adams, showing a live shot. And he said, he's gone. Alan's dead.
She said, Aneth, Alan is dead. And it was just, what, how is, you know, just silence.
He turned on the mic and he said, Alan Berg was shot. And all of a sudden, I found myself falling down into a black void.
You know, and as I describe that to you, I can visualize it again. That long, thin body sprawled out on the ground. And all these big, I suppose, police lights.
It was like a bad dream. And I thought I was going to faint.
I didn't even know what to say.
Ken was on talking about it, and he actually addressed the killers.
You're a loser, talk show host, or a dime a dozen. If Alan Berg was anything before you blew him away, he was nothing. And you made him immortal. You made him a part of me. You gave value to everything that ever justified your sick act tonight.
The realness of it was just about impossible to take in, except there was Alan sprawled outside of his VW in his carport area of his condo townhouse with his beloved Airedale upstairs holding a sack of dog food. I mean, it was impossible to believe and also just horrendous.
Berg's murder, the investigation, and the trial that followed is its own long story. And if you want to know more about it, there's a podcast miniseries called The Order of Death.
In short, David Lane and three other members of the white nationalist group called The Order believe that Alan Berg was part of a Jewish conspiracy to take over the world. The Order believed that killing him would eventually lead to the creation of an all-white state. Several members of The Order eventually went to prison for charges mostly unrelated to Berg's murder.
Here's Mark Potok. He works at a place called the Center for Analysis of the Radical Right, and he used to work at the Southern Poverty Law Center.
I mean, I think that The Order was the first of the truly revolutionary extreme right racialist organizations in this country.
What he means by truly revolutionary is that prior to The Order, most white nationalist violence and terrorism in the U.S. was what he calls restorationist. Groups like the KKK, he says, wanted to return to the quote-unquote good old days of formal segregation, if not slavery.
The Order, on the other hand, wanted an all-out race war.
And in effect, it opened a new era, an era which we are still living in today. You know, today it's not so shocking to see the murder, say, of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, or to see the mass murder of black churchgoers carried out by Dylann Roof in Charleston, South Carolina. Those kinds of things, while not precisely every day, are very common now on the radical right, simply murdering a bunch of people, either because you want to get attention or you think that they are somehow your enemies or representative of your enemies.
The order's influence on the modern-day radical right, he says, can't be underestimated.
For example, while in prison, order member and Denver native David Lane went on to become one of the most prominent neo-Nazis in America. And he still has an outsized influence on white nationalists today.
It would be easy to end the story here, to draw a faint line between Allenberg's murder by a radicalized group of angry white supremacists and incidents of white supremacist violence like Charlottesville and other recent attacks.
But we want to go back to something talk show host Peter Boyle said earlier in the episode.
And they don't call them fans, they call them marks. And they believe it's real. And that was the part about Allen, was Allen was wrestling. They were marking. And there are people that believe all kinds of stuff. Belief is far more powerful than knowledge.
I can't conceive that everything I've said in all these years preceding this night, you never agreed with. That's inconceivable to me. Well, I don't agree with myself most of the time.
Well, I do agree with you on the fact that...
If Berg's death marked a turning point for the radical right, it also marked a turning point for American political discourse.
With Berg's murder, these provocations that political talk show hosts may have seen as more or less innocent fun became more than just wrestling.
The pretend outrage that drove ratings and advertising revenue had an audience of angry marks for whom the outrage was real.
Even though talk radio didn't invent confrontational political discourse, it's definitely one of the early forces that commercialized it.
And that blurry line between sales-driven provocation and real-life consequences is, in some ways, built into the very DNA of political talk radio.
Here are Jeffrey Berry and Andrew Horvitz, radio experts that we heard from earlier.
There's always been anger, an angry element of our population in terms of politics. That's part of freedom. It's part of a democracy that people can say what they want. So what we've emphasize in our research is that increasingly peddling outrage became a for-profit business.
People get very, very excited. And I don't think the people who are espousing all of this vitriol sometimes are really understanding the full impact that their words can hold, especially when they speak from the positions of power that they do. So danger, danger, danger.
And again, Rush Limbaugh first came on the air in 1984, the same year Allen Berg was assassinated.
A little history lesson for you. If any race of people should not have guilt about slavery, it's Caucasians.
But yeah, there's a danger in that. You're to put a little less of a articulate way of saying it, those are fighting words. And Limbaugh was like, you know, he's like a goddamn Jedi Knight when it comes to it, for better or worse.
Limbaugh wasn't the first to use outrageous broadcasts for political power, but Horvitz and Berry say in some ways he popularized the use of controversial entertainment as a political tool in the United States.
It was Limbaugh, says Jeffrey Berry, who opened the door to the same style of saber-rattling political entertainment on television and later on the internet.
Fox and MSNBC came onto the cable scene. Provocative websites from the Daily Caller on the right to the Daily Kos on the left emerged in great numbers. And now with social media, all of the preceding, you know, what goes on talk radio gets recycled through Twitter and Facebook.
Andrew Horvitz says that today, the line between politics, entertainment, and reality is blurrier than ever.
Oh, I would say Trump is our talk radio president. He's our reality television president. But I think there was a big tie between, you know, the kind of reality television where it was just that blatant, no holds barred competition. A lot of that translated from the rhetoric I think you would have gotten from talk radio, right?
You know, Ted, these people are laughing at you. I mean, I'm sorry.
You know what? Let me just say something really quick.
Why should you interrupt me when I'm knocking
because,
him?
Because
interrupting me when I'm knocking him, what are you doing to yourself?
Because I'm being truthful, and I'll always be truthful.
Is that, right?
It's not stupid.
Here I am. I'm getting ready practically to fire this guy, and you keep interrupting me and stopping me from doing it. And in the end, what Carolyn said to you is true.
I want him to be
fired.
She
said, what have you done? And you couldn't answer it. You know what, Summer? You're fired.
The problem is the media, and I'm going to hesitate to use the word mainstream because this is really journalism more broadly, they weren't designed to handle somebody like him.
President Trump understands how to use outrage, and he uses it to command media attention. And it works. It not only pleases conservatives, but it's catnip for cable TV and talk radio, which wanted, you know, find that discussing it builds an audience and brings their audience back, makes their audience angry. So anger sells.
Andrew Horvitz says that regardless of what you think of Trump's policies, he's a master of dominating news cycles by saying outrageous things.
But those are great headlines. If you were a publisher, why would you not run those? I mean, you know, that's going to sell papers. And your other option is if you don't run those and every other outlet is talking about said comments, you're going to be out of that, you know, part of the, you're going to be out of that discussion, which means, you know, whatever that means for your circulation size and your readers and your ratings and all of that.
And it's important to point out that the mainstream media has been lamenting this change in discourse while simultaneously cashing in on it for decades.
Listen to CBS reporter Morley Safer interviewing Allen Berg for 60 Minutes in January 1984, just 6 months before Allen was murdered.
Isn't there something a little dangerous about this kind of broadcasting?
There is a danger. I agree with you. But I think that's the danger that we exhibit in all free, all rights of free expression, be it columnists who write newspapers.
Yeah, indeed. But you say yourself, you often go on there. You don't know quite what you're going to say.
Hopefully, my legal training will prevent me from saying the one thing that will kill me. And I've come awfully close.
Everyone from Fox News to the New York Times gets a payday in a culture of outrage as entertainment.
A Forbes article from April 2018 points out that cable news, as well as the supposedly more respectable network outlets, have all seen ratings bumps since Trump's announcement that he was running for president.
And an article in The Atlantic says that print publications like the New York Times, Washington Post, and The New Yorker also saw an increase in subscriptions after Trump's election. Not to mention online publications like Slate and Vox, which have settled into a routine of almost constant Trump coverage.
Peter Boyles told us politicians and the media both benefit from making marks of their audience.
So is Donald Trump on some level a professional wrestler?
Oh, sure. They all are. No politician I know that I've really had any affection for. Jack Kennedy wrestled pro. Reagan got it. Berg had it. Ocasio-Cortez got it. I'm not a fan, but she got it. She hit the scene. She knew how to do it. The media loved her. She can say whatever she wants to say, but she has the spotlight. Trump pimps these people intentionally to get them to react, and then everybody goes bat crap.
You want to challenge me to a match at WrestleMania?
Absolutely right. 100%. I will kick your ass.
Oh!
Boyle says that while Allen Berg is by no means solely responsible for the kind of outrage entertainment that paved the way for everyone from Rush Limbaugh to Donald Trump, he definitely played his part.
He loved people. But boy, when that guy threw that mic switch, bang, you know, we were doing it for money. Yeah, don't ever kid yourself. It was money.
The price we all pay, says Boyles, comes when outrage as commercial entertainment becomes reality as violence.
You know, I think it was some Aristotelian thing of, you know, little boys kill frogs in sport, but frogs die in earnest. And he's doing a radio show. And I remember saying that night that, like Harper Lee, they killed the Mockingbird. They know they killed. They killed this guy that they thought was the voice of the Jewish occupation government or some insanity. And if you knew him, wasn't even close. I mean, but that's who they thought he was.
So do you think we should call Alan one more time?
Let's do it.
54-7, please. Well run.
Okay.
You're listening to Alan Berg on News Talk 85 KOA. Call him at 861-TALK.
Alan Berg on KOA. We have about 4 minutes remaining in the hour, 5 minutes of CBS News, grain report coming up, then back with our final segment of the show. Lines are full right now. Let's go to line two. You're on KOA.
Hi, Alan. It's Nolan Tyler calling again from the future.
I'm sorry, what?
Nolan Tyler from the future?
Oh, my God. What are you going to do to me?
Wait, before you hang up, we were just wondering if we could ask what you'd like people in the future to know about how talk radio works.
It's an entertainment business. We're in a mass media situation. We're competing with 33 stations, I think, in this community. And you have to entertain the people. There's all kinds of wants from the people out there. But first and foremost, you have to hold their attention. However you do that, and there's different styles. There is no one style of doing talk radio. Oh, I do think mine is the best.
But it's not just entertainment, is it? Do you feel like you're trying to make people think?
They want to vent feelings, but they don't want to think. You ask somebody, why do you believe that? I don't know. Why do you bother me? That's the way I believe. I don't know. I believe it. That's a tragic way to think in a lifetime. They're like sheep. They pick up an idea. The Republicans are great. The Democrats are great. Never once saying, well, wait a minute. Let me examine this. What are they really doing? They have no information. They go to the polls. It's clown city to think that they're purely hyped by the media, by advertising, what have you. They buy a president the same way they buy a toothpaste. There is no difference.
But don't you think it's a problem that talk radio profits so much from provoking those people? Is there a way to succeed in this business without just pissing people off all the time?
People do not want to talk about good things. If I came on the air today and I said, today we can only discuss good things, I would never get a call. I get one or two calls, and it would be so boring, you'd cry. People really want to dislike something. They want to blame something in this world. They want to get angry at something. And mostly, because classic doctrine I see occur in talk radio, it's called transference of blame. It's Reagan's fault. It's the mayor's fault. It's the police chief's fault. Always someone else's fault. It's my wife's fault. It's my kid's fault. It's never their fault. They're all victims. I never heard so many victims in my life. And I ended up being the victim.
The raw deal. Day 100 of the Clinton administration.
Now that's what I call being completely wrong about Iraq.
I don't like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay.
A copy of Donald Trump's tax returns.
Get him out of here. Get out.
We need to kill them. We need to kill them. The radical Muslim terror.
This problem of anti-Muslim attacks, they have been on the rise since...
News, a horrific scene in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Like a fool.
All right, we have breaking news.
Breaking news.
Again, if you want to learn more about Alan Berg, the trial of the members of the Order, and the legacy of their ideology, check out the podcast The Order of Death by Denver-based producers Josh Madison and Shannon Geis.
Lost Highways is a production of History Colorado and History Colorado Studios. It's made possible by a generous grant from the Sturm Family Foundation, with particular thanks to Stephen Sturm and Emily Sturm.
If you enjoyed this podcast and want to support it, please become a member of History Colorado. You can get 20% off your membership at historycolorado.org/podcast discount. Plus, you get all kinds of great benefits like free admission to our 8 museums around the state.
And even if you don't become a member, you can still get $2 off admission to any of our museums just by mentioning the podcast.
Thanks to Eric Whitney, our editor for this episode, and to Connor Bergal, who composed the music.
And to Judith Berg, Jerry Bell, and KOA, all of whom helped provide archival audio for this episode. We also talked to Kevin Flynn for background information. He and his colleague Gary Gerhart wrote a book called The Silent Brotherhood, Inside America's Racist Underground.
Many thanks to our editorial team, Chief Creative Officer Jason Hansen, Sam Bach, Sean Boyd, Brooke Gladstone, Steve Grinstead, Lydia Hooper, Kimberly Cronwall, Jose Ortega, Julie Peterson, Angel V. Hill, Marisa Volpe, and Zach Workowicz.
And to our advisory group, which includes Stephen Sturm, Emily Sturm, Chief Creative Officer Jason Hansen, Thomas Andrews, Jonathan Futa, Charlie Woolley, Susan Schulten, Tom Romero, and Kara DeGette.
Finally, thanks to the entire staff of History Colorado. I'm Noel Black.
And I'm Tyler Hill. Thanks for listening.